Today on Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
The story doesn't always end with a miraculous deliverance, but here's the lesson, is that even when God preserves us through a trial, instead of delivering us from a trial, His deliverance is still real. Don't despair. Don't think that it always has to make sense, that it always has to be something that wins in this obvious victory. Sometimes God's greatest work is by being faithful to us to the very end, no matter what our suffering.
As Pastor David continues his teaching through the book of Acts, he'll be explaining how God is always in control, even when we go through the storms of life. The Apostle Paul in our text today is a prisoner on a ship that is about to become shipwrecked. God didn't deliver him out of this trial, but he was faithful to help Paul endure through the trial. There are times when you will face trials, and God will allow you to walk through them, but he will always work it out for your ultimate good. Now, here's Pastor David in Acts chapter 27, verse 27, with today's study.
Back at a place called Fair Havens, Paul said, "I don't think we should sail on." And they said, "Well, whatever, preacher, we're going on." Then secondly, when Paul offered them some encouragement on the sea after his great "I told you so" moment, they started to listen to him. Now they'll believe anything Paul says about sailing that ship. You say they shouldn't go? Fine, we're cutting the ropes, they're gone. And so that's what they did. The ropes were cut, the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff, and they let it fall off. It seems that the centurion and the soldiers had tremendous trust in Paul. Now verse 33. "And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day you've waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you.'" Paul gathers together the passengers, and now they're listening to him with a new authority, aren't they? And he tells them, "Eat something. Strengthen yourselves. I know you haven't felt like eating because of seasickness for the last 2 weeks. I know that the food is wet and moldy, but eat something. You need a little bit of strength. We're almost there. I know you're terrified because the ship is being broken up and it's a bad thing awaiting us as soon as the dawn comes. But you need to eat something. You need to take some strength." And this is what he did. He assured them, "Not a hair of your head will fall of any of you." Now, I find this interesting, the promise that Paul made to them. I believe it was a promise of God to them, don't you? I mean, God had promised such. Do you understand that the promise was only worth anything to the people who believed it? There they are, completely stressed out. Every nerve is firing. They're so afraid that it's that combination of fear and dread filling their soul. And then Paul says, "Don't worry, it's going to be okay." Now, if you don't believe Paul and just go on worrying as before, that promise does you no good. But if you were to believe it, it would mean everything to you. This is how it is with the promises of God in our life. He makes us promises. He gives us gifts. He displays his loving care and goodness and grace towards us. But I'll be very honest with you, it doesn't do you a bit of good unless you believe it and embrace it by faith. Years ago, for a few summers, we would take trips whitewater rafting with our children. This is the closest I've really come to rough seas, whitewater rafting on the South Fork of the American River. It was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed these times. And one particular time I was there, and if I remember right, I was there with at least a couple of my sons. There were my sons there, and I can't remember if our daughter was with us, but I do remember very clearly it was Nathan and Jonathan there with me in the raft, and we're making our way down, and we had the best captain of our ship of all, the Pastor Joe, because it was a church that ran these men. It's just great. He knew exactly how to shoot through the rapids. He knew exactly how to turn the boat around and to tell this side to paddle and that side to paddle, and it was tremendous. There were times when it was scary. You'd really be going down some rapids and, you know, it'd be dicey. And once Jonathan fell in the water and Joe just picked him right up and brought him into the boat. And it was a great time, but at times a little bit scary. Well, there was one young boy in our boat. I can't even remember his name because it was him and his mom. Every time it started to get a little bit rough on the river, he would curl up in a little ball on the floor of the boat and just sort of moan and wail. And there we were all just, "Yahoo! You know, isn't this great?" And this poor little guy, there he is moaning and you know, just having a miserable time of it on the bottom of the boat there. And this is what I thought afterwards. I thought, you know what? He was just as safe in that boat as we were. We had a good captain. We just trusted our captain. Joe's not going to let anything bad happen to us. He knows what he's doing. He's been down this river 100 times before, and probably literally 100 times before he had been down that river. We don't have a thing to worry about. And we enjoyed it. He was miserable. Why? Because we trusted our captain. He, for whatever reason, he didn't. Now, we all got to the destination safely, but we enjoyed it, and he was miserable. It's the same thing with these people on the shipwreck. They were all going to be okay. It was God's promise to them. But if they would have trusted the promise of God, they would have gained some encouragement, some strength. They could have enjoyed the ride. I don't think anybody enjoys a shipwreck, but they could have enjoyed it more than they did. What's going on now? Verse 35. When he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Does that suggest anything to the people in this room? Doesn't it sound like Paul is leading them in communion in the Lord's table? And I wonder if they even knew it. I wonder if Paul said it like this. And as you're eating, let me say something about who Jesus is and what he did for us on the cross. Can't you just imagine Paul saying that in that context? And maybe for some of the people, they didn't really get it. But for Paul and for those who believe, we know at least there were two other believers on that ship, Luke and Aristarchus. And who knows how many of them Paul led to the Lord. You got to figure that's a pretty fertile ground for evangelism when you're 2 weeks on a miserable ship. Yes, whatever, Paul. Yes, I believe. Paul leads them in communion, or at least it seems like it. That's the feel of it there from verse 35. It will be like this. I'm leading you. I'm going to take bread. I'm giving thanks in the presence of all. He broke it. And then it says, verse 36, then they were all encouraged. And they also took food themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. The last of the cargo, maybe just what they were keeping for their own supplies, for their own nourishment. Forget it. No reason to keep that anymore. Shore is here. Jettison everything. Everything's off the boat. Now, verse 39. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. You can just picture all this in your mind. There it is. There's a beach. It looks like sand. Let's run for it. Cut loose the anchors. Put up the sail. Let's do whatever we can to run it aground because it looks like some sandy ground. And that's exactly what they did. Now, verse 39 also tells us that they didn't recognize the land. They didn't know where they were landing. But we know, and they learned a little bit later, it's actually they came to an island called Malta. The place where the ship came aground is now called St. Paul's Bay. Now, I want you to notice something. I know you can't see it all that well on the map that's on the PowerPoint, but what they did was they just ran free, and who knows how many loop-de-loops. On the little line I make on the PowerPoint map there, it looks like a straight line. Friends, it might not have been a straight line at all. They might have been running quite a few loop-de-loops there, going who knows where in the Mediterranean Sea. They drove blind for 2 weeks, and then they came to the island of Malta. And what you need to understand is the island of Malta is just this little island in the midst of the Mediterranean Sea. They had no hand on the rudder, but they landed at exactly the right place. Matter of fact, if they would have swept by Malta, which was entirely reasonable, there would have been another 200 miles to go on the Mediterranean until they would have hit the Tunisian coast. And nobody would have expected the ship or the people to last that long. And so they hit this little speck in the middle of the Mediterranean, because even though there was not a single human hand on that rudder, can't you see God steering the ship exactly where he wanted it to go so that it would come to the island of Malta? So verse 41, but striking a place where the two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow struck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. You can just picture this. You can almost feel it. The ship's rushing towards shore, and then all of a sudden there's a tremendous collision as it implants its front, its prow, right there into the sand. And so that's stuck firmly into the sand. But what happens to the back of the boat? Well, those waves, that stormy condition that had lasted for weeks, it suddenly didn't turn off so that they could have an easy exit from the boat. No, the waves are crashing on the stern of the ship, the back of the ship, and it's breaking it apart. And everybody understands it's now or never. We have to get off in this wind, in this storm, in this driving rain, and hope we make it to shore. Verse 42. I love verse 42. If it wasn't bad enough, verse 42. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. You know, just when you think it's as bad as it could be, they're all wondering, will we ever survive? And the soldiers are wondering, will we ever be able to kill them all? Now, there were 276 passengers on the ship. Not all of them were prisoners. We don't know how many of them were prisoners. In my mind, I'm thinking, and this is just a guess, I'm thinking 20, 30 of them were prisoners. I really don't know. It could have been more. But let's just say you had 20, 30 prisoners on the ship, and the soldiers are thinking, we have to kill them, because if we don't kill them, they're going to escape. And if they escape, the penalty that they deserved goes upon our head. You see, most of those prisoners, not like Paul, most of those prisoners were going toward their execution. They were going to be marched into Rome, and at the Colosseum or a similar arena, they were going to face the gladiators or the wild beasts, and they would be publicly executed. That's the whole reason why they were going to Rome. Now, since those prisoners were destined to death, if by some reason they should escape, that same penalty would come upon the soldiers who were supposed to be guarding them. So the soldiers very logically felt, it's either them or us. I'd rather have them dead than me dead. So let's kill them all. But look at what happens here in verse 43. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, I love that, kept them from their purpose and commanded those who could swim should jump overboard first and go to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was that they all escaped safely to land. They all got there. Isn't it wonderful, the favor that God gave Paul in the eyes of the centurion? And that favor kept Paul and all of the prisoners alive. And it was in fulfillment of what God had said to Paul that God has granted all those who sail with you. Friends, God's word never fails. He made that promise, and in the most unlikely of circumstances, that promise was fulfilled, and they made it to shore. Now, one thing I do have to add about verse 44. Verse 44 is famous among, well, at least California Bible students, because it's the surfing verse in the Bible. At least in the New King James Version, this is what it says. It says, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship, they came to shore. Well, if they came to shore on boards, it could have been that Paul surfed to the shore of Malta. Now, it could have been that they were so weakened by the storm that all they could do was bodyboard in. But there could have been some stand-up paddlers among them. I don't know. But if you want a biblical justification of surfing, here it is. Make a note of it in your Bible. Acts chapter 27, verse 44. Now, we're going to come a few verses into chapter 28. Let's take a look at it. Now, when they had escaped, then they found out that the island was called Malta. By the way, the name Malta means refuge. Isn't that a great title for this island? They came to Malta, and the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. You have to put yourself in this mentality. They were in a terrible storm that lasted weeks. And so the waves were pounding. The wind was blowing. It was cold. It was wet. It was miserable. They were so happy to be on shore. By the way, can you just imagine how happy you would be on shore after 2 weeks of that? You would be kissing the beach on the sand. Just you couldn't believe how fortunate you were, how blessed you were to be saved. And not only that, but it says there in verse 2 that the natives made them all welcome. They built a fire. They welcomed. Please come. We can tell you're miserable. We can tell you've been through a great ordeal. Let us comfort you. Let us bless you. Now look at verse 3. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, by the way, isn't it wonderful to see the great apostle Paul helping in a very practical way? He doesn't just find some kind of ancient Maltese equivalent of an easy chair and say, Luke and Aristarchus, why don't you guys get to work? No, he's gathering sticks. They need wood for the fire. We're cold. Let's do it. So Paul says, well, I'm worthy of this work. I'll just go and start doing it. Paul gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire. Verse 3, a viper came out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. Thank you very much. Can't you just imagine Paul thinking, when's it going to end? And you know, it's a logical question for us to ask sometimes. You know, somebody spoke to me after last week, this great encouragement that Paul gave to the people on board the ship and how they should believe God. And people ask the difficult questions, well, what if God doesn't rescue you? What if the ship crashes and lives are lost? Ladies and gentlemen, God shows so many wonderful examples of his grace and his deliverance to us. He does it time and time again. But let's face it, every one of us has an appointed time that we're going to pass from this world to the next. The story doesn't always end with a miraculous deliverance. But here's the lesson, is that even when God preserves us through a trial, instead of delivering us from a trial, his deliverance is still real. Don't despair. Don't think that it always has to make sense, that it always has to be something that wins in this obvious victory. Sometimes God's greatest work is by being faithful to us to the very end, no matter what our suffering. We think about when somebody's afflicted with some kind of sickness. We pray for them to be healed. We believe that God can heal them. We believe that God wants to heal them. But if God chooses not to heal them, then he's still God. And he's still good. We understand that God works in many different ways. And I wouldn't blame the Apostle Paul for thinking, okay, Lord, what's this now? A snake on my... Now, Paul had an advantage here. Where did God tell him he was going to end up? Rome. God did not tell him, you'll make it to Malta. And after that, who knows? No, he was going all the way to Rome. Paul could look at that snake fastened on his arm and he could simply say, I'm not in Rome yet. Forget it. You can't do anything to me. So what did he do? Well, it says, so when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, no doubt this man is a murderer whom, though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow to live. So you get the picture. The viper comes out of the wood pile and it grabs onto Paul's arm, or actually on his hand, and they see it and they exclaim, well, this is it. This is exactly, the man must be a murderer. He must deserve this. Justice will not allow this man to live. That's what it is in verse 4. Now, they believed, the natives of Malta, they believed that justice finally caught up with the prisoner. And justice here is actually a reference to the Greek goddess of justice, Diake. The natives, believing that Paul was a prisoner, they had assumed that he had committed some great crime, and the goddess of justice would not allow Paul to go unpunished. And so what happens here? They're convinced that he's a murderer and that he's going to die. Well, what happened? You saw it there starting at verse 5. But he shook off the creature in the fire and suffered no harm. I love this. Paul didn't scream, why, God, I can't take this anymore. Can't you see that I'm serving you? Paul didn't take a look around the people at the fire and say, you know what, why didn't you guys collect the wood? If you would have collected the wood, maybe this would have been you and not me. Instead, almost calmly, he seems to shake the snake off of his hand into the fire, and he suffered no harm. Verse 5, however, he shook off the creature into the fire, suffered no harm. However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. But when they had looked for a long time and saw no harm come to him, they changed their mind and said that he was a god. Isn't that just perfectly human nature? It runs hot and cold, doesn't it? First, you're a murderer and you deserve to die. Justice will not allow you to live. Next, you're a god. Neither one of them were true. But Paul understood God has this purpose for my life and it cannot be derailed. I can take God's past faithfulness as a promise for his future blessing and protection. But you know, actually that there's a great picture here for us to see. When that snake bit Paul on the hand and the native said, justice will not allow him to live. They believed that justice had a claim against Paul because he must have been a murderer. Do you know something about the life of Paul before he was converted by the power of Jesus Christ? I've got news for you. He was a murderer. He really was. And assuming Paul could understand what these natives from Malta were saying, it would have registered in his mind, they're right. I am a murderer. Justice, raw justice, might require that I die. But then Paul remembered, justice has been satisfied for me at the cross. Anything that should be poured out upon me by the justice of God, instead it was put upon Jesus as he hung on the cross. And isn't that the great message that Paul preached? The preaching of that message is the reason why he got in trouble all over the Roman Empire. Because he went around telling people that divine justice can be satisfied on their behalf if they'll put their trust in who Jesus is and what he did for them on the cross. And so if the snake bites you, it's as if the snake has no more venom. All the poison is gone. Do you know why? Because all the poison was poured out upon Jesus on the cross. There's no more poison in that snake of divine justice. Oh, it might bite you. Oh, you'll see it. You'll have to shake it off into the fire. Oh, other people may say, oh, well, he deserves it, on and on. No, divine justice has been satisfied. That's a toothless snake, and even if it has teeth, it has no venom, because all the venom that should have gone to you by divine justice was poured out upon Jesus. And here's the point. You and I, we can't survive that snake bite, can we? But Jesus could. Jesus could allow that serpent, so to speak, to strike him on the cross. And not only did he survive, he resurrected in glory, having finished it and having paid the price. Well, they looked at this and they looked at the triumphant apostle Paul and they said he was a god. They were wrong on both counts. He was a murderer, but that's not why the snake struck him. And again, he wasn't a god. But we saw this fulfilling the promise. God fulfilled his promise to Paul, first of all, in the providence of surviving the shipwreck. That's a big deal. They made it through. They were safe on land right now on the island of Malta. But here's the other place. God showed his goodness in having his justice satisfied. It had no more claim on Paul. Is that true for you? Can you say that God's justice is satisfied for you? If that serpent of God's justice were to strike you, is there any more venom? Is there any more poison in it? The only way to leech the poison out of that serpent is to trust in who Jesus is and what he did for you on the cross. Then his payment for sin counts unto you. But if you don't believe it, if you don't put your trust in it, the provision is there, but you don't take any credit for it. You don't take any account of it. It's not given unto you. It just happened. It happened for other people. But you can embrace it by faith, and it can happen for you.
There's much more Pastor David would like to share with you, but we've run out of time for today. This has been another edition of Enduring Word Radio, the radio ministry of David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. Pastor David will continue teaching verse by verse through the book of Acts next time. You can order today's message for free by emailing us at radio@enduringword.com. Again, that email address is radio@enduringword.com. Our phone number is 805-730-1400. We'd be happy to help you and talk with you today. Again, that number to call is 805-730-1400. You can learn more about Enduring Word Radio and Pastor David at our website, enduringword.com. All of Pastor David's messages through the Bible are available to listen to or download for free at enduringword.com. Again, that's enduringword.com. Simply click on the radio option in the main menu. Of course, for many of us, Enduring Word commentaries have been a part of our discipleship. We'd like to encourage you to consider supporting Enduring Word Radio by partnering with us with a one-time gift or monthly donation. Your support helps this program extend its reach worldwide. Well, that's all the time we have for today. From all of the production team here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to say thank you for tuning in. And please make plans to join us again for the next edition of Enduring Word Radio.